James Fox's career in film goes back more than 25 years. UFOs, 50 years of denial, Out of the Blue, I Know What I Saw, The Phenomenon, and his new movie, Moment of Contact, is exploding onto screens as we speak to strong reviews. It's a compelling examination of the Varginha incident of 1996 in Brazil, one of the most extraordinary mass encounters of our times.
In 1996, the people of Varginha, Brazil, witnessed a UFO event that would change their lives forever.
Só que ele planava, ia perdendo lentamente a altitude e ia caminhando.
Call it another Roswell, if you will. It is a crashed vehicle that had beings on board.
Mas que eles não poderiam admitir a verdade, a população ia entrar em colapso.
Nada temos a esconder.
Finally, the facts will be revealed.
The Varginha case is considered the most well-kept secret in the military circles of Brazil.
My objective here is to put some clarity on what took place in Varginha, Brazil, January 1996.
Dois seres extraterrestres foram capturados, depois, posteriormente, foram levados para o hospital.
The witnesses are some of the most compelling testimony I've ever heard.
Meu nome é Carlos de Souza.
Meu nome é Cátia Xavier.
Meu nome é Liliane Silva.
Meu nome é Valquíria Silva.
Em 1996, eu vi uma criatura estranha ali.
Action! A lot of people in this town have a little piece of the puzzle.
Naquele local, eu vi o rastro da criatura, o pé.
Foi onde ele falou que eu vi era uma coisa sobrenatural.
This year,
Mark Lixerez, he had captured this creature with his bare hands.
Te confirma que o seu irmão estava de serviço naquele dia 20.
Confirmo.
After he captured the creature, he developed this infection that wouldn't go away.
Foi pro CTI de manhã, 7 horas da manhã, 15 para o meio-dia, ele veio a óbito.
This can no longer be covered up.
They might shoot us because we're on the property.
This can't be denied.
Bateram na porta. E aí, celular pra mim.
Ficar quieto. Se qualquer um iria sofrer uma punição muito severa.
This was proof.
Pull this off. It'll be the most compelling testimony revealed.
Of contact.
Aqui, ó. Foi aqui.
This is a level of confirmation that only a handful of people on this planet have.
James Fox, welcome to The Fifth Kind.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Congratulations on Moment of Contact. You really are on a roll and getting great responses to this movie around the world. You absolutely knocked it out of the park with The Phenomenon. And the last time we spoke was when The Phenomenon was coming out. And I felt that that was a movie you could show to even the most reluctant viewer. And it really gave an encyclopedic update as to the credibility of the UFO phenomenon and where we're up to in terms of data and disclosure. So having produced that phenomenal movie, what was it about this one incident that made you feel this had to be the next project? What made you feel about the Varginha incident that there was a whole movie in this and that you had to be the one to make it? And you're willing to invest probably the best part of 2 years into getting it onto our screens.
1986, over Sao Paulo, six Brazilian fighter jets chase more than a dozen UFOs. The Ministry of the Air Force confirms this encounter in a press conference.
Os OVNIs.
Nosso objetivo justamente era esse, se aproximar e identificar. Nós não conseguimos nem nos aproximar, muito menos identificar.
Photographer Almiro Barauna and the crew aboard a Brazilian Navy vessel witness a disc-shaped object maneuvering over the ocean. He grabs his camera and takes these shots. Previously classified Brazilian Air Force documents contain accounts of several UFOs witnessed by both civilians and military personnel. Shown here are several unknown craft captured on camera by the Brazilian Air Force. Some officers even claimed to see occupants.
Não acreditava. A reação que eu tive, falei, pensei assim, como pode ser?
Depois ela desceu muito rápido, se aproximou.
Meu Deus, está baixando.
Eu pulou, pegou,
Peguei. O objeto chega bem perto das casas. Passa por trás de um poste. Passeia pelo bairro, com movimentos irregulares.
Eu não sei te explicar o que era aquilo, como fazia aqueles movimentos.
It actually dates back to out of the blue. I had just finished 50 Years of Denial. I sold it to Discovery Channel, and it was broadcast on the Learning Channel. And we were sort of huddling for the next project out of the blue. Didn't have a title at the time. It was probably like 1999 or maybe 2000. And one of my co-producers, this guy, Tim Coleman, he's like, oh, mate, he's British. He's like, mate, we gotta look into this UFO, this alleged UFO crash that happened in the town of Virginia in Brazil. And these aliens apparently were alive and walking through the town. And I thought, oh my God, I think I picked the wrong partner. This guy's lost his mind.
It was too much.
I was like, you gotta be kidding me, right? There's no way that happened, period. And I didn't think about it once, not once. I dismissed it like that. And funny enough, all these years later, I gave him a credit in the movie. Special thanks to Tim Coleman, because he was the one that turned me on to the case 22, 3, whatever years ago. And anyway, fast forward to 2011. I was going to Brazil for a conference in a place called Peruíbe. And I was going to discuss a bit of my background, and in particular, I know what I saw when I did that National Press Club event at Washington, D.C. in 2007 with Leslie Kane. And I get a phone call from a good friend of mine, this guy, Jeff Sagansky. And Jeff is a top executive in the entertainment industry, and he's had a secret interest in UFOs. And he says, oh, James, you're going to Brazil. You got to look into that Virginia case. And I thought, oh, God, not this again. So long story short, I go to Brazil. I go to the conference with no intention whatsoever of looking into Virginia. And I meet some witnesses and researchers. And that sort of piqued my interest. Following that, I decided, okay, well, I'm going to go and do some more research. And I did. And I went to Virginia 4 times, about roughly a month each time, either, you know, from Sao Paulo up to Virginia. And I was going to include that section of the film in the phenomenon. As you know, with the phenomenon, I tried to do compelling cases all around the world. We did in Africa, Australia, here in the United States, Russia. We covered some archival footage from George Knapp, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually spent probably 8 months editing with a translator the segment of Virginia that I had put together. But quite honestly, I couldn't find a way how to squeeze it in. It just didn't feel right. Yeah. And after all this travel and all this investigation, I very painfully deleted that entire section from the film, from the phenomenon. And it was one of those moments where I hit the delete button and I let out a kind of, well, that was painful, because I knew how much work had gone into it. And the film, The Phenomenon, comes out, and my Brazilian counterparts were devastated. You know, well, they loved The Phenomenon, but they were like, my God, what happened? I said, you guys, I really felt like there were eyewitness testimony, like particularly Carlos de Souza, apparently the guy who witnessed it crash, who disappeared for 26 years. I gave one grainy interview with a guy named Claudio Covo, a Brazilian UFO researcher, also an engineer. And then vanished. And then there were all these other members of the Brazilian military, doctors that we were trying to track down. And we just didn't have enough time. We needed more time. And so I said to these guys, hey, look, I know this is depressing. I know we put a lot into this over 10 years, but stick with me, stay the course. And we're gonna do an entire film on this one case. So we went back to the drawing board, spent a couple, probably about 2 more years, 1.5, very intense, but 2 years, you know, 6 months prep, 6 months, very intensive prep. And then a year of full, absolute full blown round the clock production. And there we have it, the birth of Moment of Contact.
One of the things I really love about what you've done in Moment of Contact is that by just choosing that one incident and drilling down into it and going there and speaking to the eyewitnesses, you really ground the experience so that the viewer feels the feelings and sees the things. And it's almost like a kinesthetic experience of the encounter. And probably one of the moments that brings that home, there are lots, but one is the conversation and visit with Carlos de Souza to the place where he had his close encounter.
1996, crash witness Carlos de Souza describes a similar object in this exclusive interview.
Uma aeronave abarroada, alguma coisa, foi algum avião. Aí eu resolvi seguir ele.
Now, 26 years later, the team travels with Carlos de Souza to find the crash site.
Um objeto vindo nesta direção, com esta parte arrebentada, motores, e ele desceu como se tivesse perdido a sustentabilidade, perdeu totalmente, puf, no chão. Deve ter algumas pessoas lá dentro e essas pessoas vão precisar de ajuda nesse momento. Foi aqui que caiu.
This is the spot.
Oh. Seres morreram aqui.
According to Mr. Souza, this area was covered with debris from the UFO crash. This is his first time at the crash site since 1996.
Can you tell us about how the encounter impacted his life? Because it clearly did. As you say, he disappeared for a couple of decades afterwards. What was the impact on him? And how did you feel it when you encountered him?
You know, as an investigator, and I speak for my Brazilian counterparts, it's so exciting. It's one of the highlights of our career. When you come upon a potential witness like Carlos de Souza or the women, the three girls that came within 8 to 10 feet of a live creature, according to their account,
yes.
It's so exciting because, you know, we're kind of on the outside looking in, right? And when you meet with a witness like that, you think like, okay, well, either this witness is full of doggy doo doo, in which case, you know, you can just dismiss everything going to say anyway, or they have a definitive experience that we are not alone, right? There's no in between.
Meu nome é Kátia Xavier. Em 1996, eu vi uma criatura estranha ali.
Então, a gente estava descendo, né, aqui. Eu na frente, as duas mais atrás um pouquinho. E eu olhei, avistei a criatura. Quando a Liliane gritou e eu olhei, eu senti, assim, medo.
Mas os olhos vermelhos, a pele oleosa, não deu para ver assim, boca aberta, rindo, não, feliz não, triste, encolhido, sembrante, triste. e não tinha cabelo.
1996. Based on the girl's testimony, artist Betty Rodriguez creates this drawing.
Era uma criatura que estava ali no cantinho, acuada, com medo. O medo da gente, da mesma forma que a gente ficou com medo desse ser que a gente não sabe o que é.
É, não era um humano que a gente viu, sinceramente. Não era um bicho também. É, e assim, hoje em dia, eu acho sim que é um ser de outro planeta.
Um homem não era, um bicho não era, agora o que que era, eu não sei falar. Não consigo descrever.
Na época a gente, né, era filho sempre, né, foi filho de pessoas católicas, né, e que podia ser um demônio. Então, por isso que a gente ficou com medo na época, né.
With all the witnesses that we talked to, and we had to track them down, not one witness came to us. We tracked them down, and for a long time, It was not a pleasant experience in their lives. Ridicule, laughter, the giggle factor, discrediting, threats, looking over their shoulder for decades. Some of them had to go offline and completely disappear for decades. Their own family members questioning their sanity. Every single witness that we spoke to said they'd rather it hadn't happened because they wanted their life back when they realized it wasn't going to happen. And it was such an emotional time. Like when we went back 26 years after Carlos de Souza, the alleged crash witness, and there were other people in the town that saw this cigar-shaped object, clearly in distress with a gash in the back of it and what they described as white vapor coming out the back. They said it's not smoke from a fire. It was like a white vapor. When we took Carlos back to that site, I don't know how to describe this, but it took a while to find it. And I was quite actually discouraged. In the film, it's only a couple of minutes, but in reality, we spent hours looking for that site. And I was getting quite discouraged. I thought we were just about a week into production. We're going to be there a month. And this guy can't find the crash site. Like, how could you not find? It wasn't that far off the freeway. It's Maiolini Farm. Like, my God, I just thought, oh, this is not off to a good start. And he kept saying, I could see this small white house in view. He said, I could see the debris field. I could see this piece of the craft still intact, and I could see this white house. I said, well, how certain are you of that? I'm 1,000% certain, he kept saying, and we were looking and scratching our heads. I finally took the drone up high enough, and I did an aerial view, and I saw behind a grove of trees this little white house, and I found where I thought, this has got to be the spot, and it was. And when we went down to that location, I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it. You have a witness that potentially saw a vehicle from another world crash and then, you know, being threatened at gunpoint by the military. It had a profound impact on this man. I mean, he had full grown man, tears coming down his face. I'm trying to give justice to the eyes because I remember looking into his eyes and almost like you could see film strips. He was having a flashback and he could see the scene. He could hear the trucks. He felt the threats. I mean, it was very profound, very emotional moment for him. And I had this cameraman, this guy that the DP I've been working with for quite some time. His name is David West, and he's a seasoned videographer or film guy. And he's like, I can only tell you maybe two or three other times in my 45-year career where I've seen someone get that emotional. He's like, you know, tears coming. He's like, that guy deserves an Oscar if he's lying.
You can feel that this was a moment that had changed his life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a very powerful moment. I'm going to come to the experience of the three girls in a moment, but can you, before we do that, paint a picture of what was seen? You spoke to many eyewitnesses and you've spoken about the craft that was seen, but what was the Virginia incident? What were the things that the eyewitnesses saw?
So you want to talk about the being, the creature?
Yes, I'll come to the three girls in a moment. I wondered if you could give us like a broad brush, what was the spectrum of experiences?
Sure. So it was January 1996. There were a number of people in the town of Virginia. We got a couple of them on camera, but there's also additional eyewitness testimony on camera from other Brazilian researchers. A number of people saw an unidentifiable sort of cigar-shaped object in the night sky, probably midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, that was not very high. It was flying very slowly. It looked like it was in distress. It had a gash in the side of it. It made no noise at all. It was 1996, January. This entire family saw something they want to share with us, but they don't want to have their faces revealed.
E chegando aqui, tal, o motoboy pegou, me entregou de repente, comecei a olhar uma baita que negócio em cima da minha casa.
Uma luz vermelha.
E procurando, estava doido atrás de alguma coisa. Ficava, aí a gente pegou e ficou olhando. Falei, gente, céu, o que eu estou vendo aqui hoje, eu nunca mais vou ver na vida. Não sei por que Deus me deu essa oportunidade de ver. É real, isso aconteceu, não tem como não ser. Esse caso de Virgínia foi real. Aí passou acho que uma semana, você não lembra?
Foi.
Aí veio um pessoal.
Veio o ufólogo, da NASA.
E um que me chamou a atenção na hora que saiu, só, essa conversa não houve. Foi embora.
Some of the witnesses we're talking about, in particular the two farmers that we interviewed, Oralina and I'll think of the woman's name in a second. Oralina and something Fritas. But they said it was kind of going down and they were expecting almost a sound of an impact, then it sort of regained some altitude and it was struggling for a while. I think they watched it for 30, 40 minutes. And then there was an ultralight pilot and also a professor of geography, this guy, Carlos de Souza, who's lives in Sao Paulo. And he was driving from Sao Paulo up to the state of Minas Gerais, which is where Virginia is, which is about a 5-6 hour drive outside of to the north of Sao Paulo. He remembers the date well because he was also an ultralight pilot and he was meeting some of his friends to go fly ultralight planes. And he was on the freeway. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was early dawn. And right above him was this, what he described as a cigar-shaped metallic object that was clearly in trouble. I mean, it was, it's another thing I want to mention quickly is not one witness ever said like, oh, it was an ET spaceship. It was like Carlos was thinking this is some kind of military experimental craft. I don't know what I'm looking at, but it's clearly in trouble. It looks like it's going to go down. And it went down onto this farm called the Maialini Farm, which was right off the freeway. Just, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile, maybe a half a mile, something like this. A mile at the absolute most. He gets off the freeway. He drives his car up this dirt road and he comes upon a debris field about the size of a football field. It's about 100 yards or 150 yards. And it was like a foil, like a very shiny foil-like material scattered everywhere. And this stench, he said it was so strong that his eyes were watering and he had to grab his shirt and pick it up over his nose. And it was like a sulfur ammonia and it burned all the vegetation. It was like a liquid. And he said it was just overwhelmingly powerful. And he's looking at this whole thing and he's thinking, what am I looking at here? What is this? And he could see a piece of the craft still intact, a rather large portion of it still intact. And he made his way over to some of this debris and he said he picked up this, it was light as a feather. And according to Carlos, he kind of crumpled it up and he said it just regained, when he let it go, it regained its shape.
Yeah.
At which point army trucks came in from the opposite dirt road. So he came in from one side and the opposite excuse me, the opposite direction. These trucks came in, jeeps and trucks, and he was forced at gunpoint to leave. I'm giving you the truncated version, but and he left. He did have a visit, which he describes about in the film, where these men, I know this sounds crazy, but I left it in the movie because I'd heard, I believed it, but these men in suits came and paid him a visit and knew who he was, knew where he lived, knew who he was married to, told him he didn't see what he thought he saw, never to talk about what he saw. He ultimately gave one on-camera statement to a guy named Claudio Covo, who was a Brazilian UFO researcher, on-camera statement, and then vanished for 26 years. Mm. About 6-7 days later, in the town of Varginha, roughly, I'm told, 6 miles, some people say 10 miles, maybe as the crow flies, you've got multiple eyewitnesses, civilian and fire department and police department calls pouring in about some kind of strange creature. People are seeing these strange creatures. Nobody said ET. Nobody said otherworldly. They were just freaked out because there were these very strange creatures in the town. And that was on January 20th, 1996.
On January 20th, the fire department was dispatched after receiving several calls who reported seeing something strange in the area.
Foi para dentro da mata e capturaram como uma rede, porque como você sabe, no Brasil, quando tem esses problemas do tipo caixa de marimbondo, animal peçonhento, cachorro louco...
É o bombeiro que vem.
É o bombeiro. Então acionaram o corpo de bombeiro. Nem eles mesmos sabiam.
E logo em seguida subiu um pessoal falando que o corpo de bombeiro tinha pegado um bicho logo aqui na mata embaixo.
O comentário, se era alguma coisa estranha, se era um bicho, se era gente, que tipo de comentário fizeram?
Não, eles falaram que o bicho que pegava chorava muito, chorava como uma criança.
One of the most compelling accounts of this strange creature came from three girls. There, two of them were sisters, Valkyria and Liliani. Valkyria was 14, Liliani was 16, and their friend Katya. Katya was 21 years old. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They were coming through like a little field with like there was some construction that was going on, but there were homes that were kind of half built and some of them just had some foundations. But there was a field with about knee-high tall grass, maybe a little shorter. And they were taking a shortcut on their way home. And the three girls saw this, what they thought initially, they saw some graffiti on the cinder block wall. And they were, that caught their eye. And they were looking and they saw what looked like maybe a statue, something kind of frozen in place. It was crouched down. It had its legs between it, its arms between its legs. And they were... What are we looking at here? And they got closer and closer. And when they got about 8 to 10 feet away, one of the girls could see that it was a living being. And she lets out a yell, a shriek. And this creature, according to them, it was slouched down by the wall, crouched down like this. And when she yelled, the creature turned and looked them right in the eyes. At which point, Liliani and her sister, Valkyria, grab each other and hightail it out of there. Katya, the 21-year-old, is frozen in her tracks. And they get down about, I don't know, 50 yards, 100 yards, and realize they don't have Katya. They thought it was the devil. So Liliani, the older of the two, the 16-year-old, turns around and races back up to that spot where Katya was frozen, locked eyes on this thing, and grabs her by the arm and tears her out of there. When I was interviewing the girls, I said in the field, right next to the cinder block wall where this event had taken place 26 years earlier, during that moment of contact, that when you locked eyes with this being, and that's where the title of the film came from, that moment of contact, what did you feel? Put me there. Was there any level of communication? Was there anything that you felt at all? And Katya said unequivocally, and Liliani as well, but Katya even more so, help me. I'm weak. I'm feeble. I'm suffering. Please help me. Get me out of here.
It is an incredibly powerful moment in the movie. And it's one of those movies where you see the sight, you hear the sound, and you really feel the feelings of the moment. And coming away from that encounter, I think the vulnerability of the moment is really poignant. The vulnerability for the girls who are just terrified because they don't understand what they're looking at, and then to have this eye-to-eye contact, but the vulnerability of the being itself. And something that many would ask is, what is a being that vulnerable doing traversing the great distances of interstellar space in advanced technology to end up in a field in such a vulnerable space? Was that being the pilot? Was that being part of a family? Was it a child? Was it cargo? How do you interpret what they encountered?
You know, I can't. That's the problem. And I've heard speculation on sort of a biologically engineered design for space exploration, almost like we send down drones. I'm not saying this is coming from me. I've heard that. But the thing about it is that the being had feelings, according to the women. In fact, according to other witnesses, we got other witnesses that heard the first capture with the fire department, and it was crying like a child, according to eyewitnesses. It's in the film. And we also got statements, because people say, you know, why, you know, how come you didn't include the fire department, the first capture earlier that day? Well, our team met with the fire department people that did capture, and they confirmed what had happened on videotape, but they did not want that released. They weren't ready yet. But anyway, if you want me to continue with what happened a little later that day, I will, or we can, you know. But I don't answer your question. I just simply don't know. I wish I did, but I don't.
I understand. It's just a real point of wonder from that really powerful encounter. I love the fact that you connect us so viscerally with all the witnesses, that we're not just hearing stories from, you know, random people. You know, here we're hearing from a college professor. Here we're hearing from these three girls, and we really get into the experience of it. Here we're talking to a television reporter. Here we're hearing testimony from military personnel. I was going to ask about, you had a conversation with Nye Nadia, who is a local TV reporter whose friend died after encountering one of these entities and handled it. Wonder if you could go into that story for us.
Absolutely. So I drew a little diagram. I took the drone, and this is the first time this has been done on this case. And a lot of the Brazilian researchers, these light bulbs went on for all of us, actually. And the epicenter of activity, and there was activity all around Virginia, military blockades and all the rest of it, but the epicenter was, I would say, if your audience can see this, you've got military blockade. Let me get on the other side of this, if this helps. You've got a military blockade here. We have eyewitness accounts of that. Military blockade there. We got the girls' encounter here. And here is where the alleged capture took place. So it's all within, like, I don't know, 5 or 6, 7 blocks of each other. Roughly 2 to 2.5 hours after this encounter with the three girls. And of course, that story spread like wildfire. I mean, it was across Brazil in minutes. I mean, everybody was talking about it. You get two patrol military police officers, Eric Lopes and Marco Cherisi. They're on patrol, on the lookout for something unusual. They were not told a UFO crash and there are live aliens wandering around the town. They just were on the lookout for something unusual. They were driving down this road just a few blocks away from where the girls had encountered this being, this entity, whatever you want to call it, about 2.5 hours later, and this thing scurries across the road in front of them. The driver, Eric Lopes, slams his brakes on. The passenger, Marco Cherisi, leaps out and grabs this thing with his bare hands. It put up almost no fight. I guess he got a scratch, maybe here on his arm. And he puts it in the back seat, I'm told on his lap, and they drive. Well, they go to one clinic, And apparently the doctor came out at this one clinic and said, get that thing out of here. I don't know what that thing is, but I don't want nothing to do with it. And so they went to another hospital called the regional hospital. According to family, his family, he had like this, and other Brazilian researchers we talked to, he had this oily, slimy stuff on his skin and the smell, and he was getting rubbing alcohol and trying to get it off of him. And within a couple of weeks, he fell ill and he wasn't feeling right. And he admitted himself to the ER. The doctor, Dr. Cesario, who worked on him, also went on camera for us. And he basically says that Marco Schrizzi told him what had happened because he was trying to save his own life. And that he was sworn to secrecy from the military. The doctor says this on camera. But in any case, the doctor said he'd never seen anything quite like it because he had this infection. He was giving him all these antibiotics, and his body just wasn't responding. His immune system was failing. He was a healthy 23-year-old military officer. And Marco Trezzi died. The family fought for explanations. They wanted to put his body in the ground immediately, according to his family. They had to fight for years to get the autopsy report. It's just the craziest story.
Military police officers Eric Lopes and Marco Cerezzi drive down this road on the lookout for something unusual when suddenly it runs right across their path.
It was captured by Marco Cerezzi with his bare hands, easily, and taken to the hospital. He developed this infection that wouldn't go away. And for 2 or 3 weeks, it was getting worse and worse and worse. And it looks like that his immunity system was shut down. This were the words used by one of the doctors who treated him, who said that he never saw in his whole medical career anything like that. And that infection killed him.
That story was shut down. It was really strongly suppressed at that time.
Very much
and,
so.
And yet you were able to track down the working partner he was with at that
Eric
time,
Lopes.
Eric Lopes, which is a very interesting PS to that story. Tell us about that moment. It's a rather dramatic one.
So back in like 2013, Marta Tavares, who's Eric, the deceased military officer's sister, she wanted nothing more. They were unable to get statements from Eric Lopes. He'd been in hiding. She was encouraging me to go and track him down. She gave me some leads. We tried and we failed. I talked to other Brazilian UFO researchers who tried and they failed. Pacaccini, Ubarajara. In fact, I'm told that Ubarajara might have met with him once, but that was it. But he was completely unreachable, completely off the radar, and every other possible option had been exhausted. At which point, when I met with the local town mayor, Mayor Verge, he offered his assistance. He felt the case was real. He said this all on camera. He felt that this really did happen. He knew a lot of the witnesses personally. He had known indirectly Marco Cerezzi, the military officer who died. And he said, look, if there's anything I can do, just tell me. We left, and I thought, yeah, in fact, being the town mayor, there is something you could do to help us. Find Eric Lopes, which he did. We met in the town plaza. He had arranged for us to meet with the former chief sergeant of the police. I'm not sure if he was stationed in Varginha or just outside Varginha at the time. And his son, this guy Homolo, who was used to be a politician, is now a lawyer. And Homolo had grown up with Eric Lopes. He hadn't seen him in a long, long time, but they knew each other way back from childhood. So Homolo, at the behest of the town mayor, agrees to escort us out to Eric Lopes' house. Just as we're departing, we're following them. We had two production trucks with gear. And as we were leaving, I thought, because what he was going to do is he was going to take us to his house and then just say, here's his house. The rest is on you guys. The last minute, I thought, hold on a second. And I put the car in park and I went out to the Mercedes that he was driving with a translator. And I said, you know, on second thought, would you mind actually walking up to the front door with us? And I honestly think that that move saved my life. I really do. When we got to his house, and you could see this in the film, boy, this guy had been in hiding. I mean, it's just, when you see where this guy is living, I mean, we drove down that long dirt road and, oh my God, it was like a scene out of a Quentin Tarantino film. And we get up to his door, the homolo, along with his 8 or 10 year old son, kind of got up to the house just in front of me. I was following behind, and I hear some talking, but I'm not sure where it's coming from. I don't know what's going on. I'm slightly confused, and I'm looking. There's nobody at the front door. I'm looking behind me, and all of a sudden, I realize there's a gentleman in the window on the second floor looking down at us. And I remember seeing his face, and I thought to myself, I've never seen like a face like it. Not the ethnicity, not the eye color, but to me, and this does not come across on camera, to me, this was the face of a man who'd been harboring, shouldering, burdened with a deep, dark secret, something that was clearly gnawing on him, eating him alive. The face, I'll never forget the eyes, just the way his face was. I just was looking at it. I was like, my God, who is that guy? What am I? And he's saying that everything's happening really quickly. And I, you know, what I'm not hearing and what I'm not aware of, because I was sort of fixated, was that he was saying, well, the first thing he said when we walked up, which I found out later, was, if you're here to talk about the ET, Eric Lopes won't talk ever, something like this. But he referred to himself in the third person. So I was saying, you know, who is this? Is this Eric Lopes? You know, kind of thing. No, it's not Eric Lopes. It's Eric Lopes' friend. But I'm looking at this guy. I'm thinking, boy, this guy, there's something about this man. Mm-hmm. And then he starts to threaten to shoot everybody three times. I am at the whole time. I'm just, you know, I'm desperately, because, you know, for over 12 years, I've been hearing about this driver. I've been hearing about it from the sister of the deceased officer. I'm thinking maybe this is this guy, Eric Lopes. And then he reveals that he is Eric Lopes. And then he, again, reminds everyone that bullets are going to start flying if we don't get out of there. But I didn't know this because the translators didn't tell me that in real time. And so I'm just desperately trying to get a statement out of him. And ultimately, I was unsuccessful. But yeah, that was a very, very intense moment in the film. And I've never experienced anything like it. In fact, the audio guy had never experienced it. The cameraman had never experienced anything like it. The lawyer had never, all of us. I mean, it was a very, very intense moment. And it all just unfolded as it unfolded. And we got what we got on camera as it happened.
It really gives us a hint, not only of how life-changing the encounter was, but how life-changing the suppression of the incident was, that many of these witnesses had threats made by their own military against them should they ever breathe a word about what had happened. And to live with that kind of fear for yourself, your family, your children, your grandchildren, you know how these threats go, to carry that for decades, that's the kind of feeling that I think,
and that he lost,
you tap in that moment.
And that he lost one of his childhood friends that they worked together
in a terrifying way that he can't understand. It brings me to the aspect of suppression and how you found the experience of gathering witnesses, because even without military threats being spoken over your family in the USA, and Australia is very similar, experiences of close encounters are usually shrouded with silence, denial, looking the other way, ridicule. Did you find that it took a great deal to get witnesses to come forward? Or after 25 years, were people more willing to come forward with their stories?
Absolutely, nearly impossible. In fact, I thought we were going to fail. I really did. It was so precarious, particularly Military X and the gentleman that was at Regina's Hospital, who the X-ray technician. That story was chilling to me. But we had found him because he had told one of his students about the incident. And 10 years later, my partner, Marco Leal, had met one of those students. And she said, yeah, my teacher told us about this, but it was really silent and not to talk. So we located him. I think Marco found him like 7 years ago, but he was still working as an X-ray technician at Regional Hospital. And he said, he'll never come forward. But he confirmed he confirmed it to Marco. He retired. I think Marco tried again for 4 years after that, and then again 2 years after that. And then to our absolute amazement, he finally agreed to meet with us, providing we shoot him from the back and disguise his voice. Well, look, we'll take what we can get. We know who he is. He provided photographs of him. We found him 8-9 years earlier. That was chilling. Something about hearing him taking those x-rays of something in a black body bag, and he described the exact same smell that everybody else described, and the secrecy and the threats and the armed guards with the military presence at the hospital. The fact that he was unable to look at those first time ever. When he takes x-rays, he always looks to see they processed correctly. But in this case, they wouldn't let him do that. This event never happened. On his way, Military X. He has been a known target for 26 years, probably maybe a week or two prior to us meeting with him. He said, all the money in the world is not going to get me to come forward. And then somehow he said, look, I'll meet with, it's a long story. I'm not going to bore your audience with all the details, but suffice to say that I convinced him with Marco's help to just have a meeting off the record, just to meet. And then he started to consider possibly meeting with us. I'll think about it kind of thing. His wife was leaving him. He was in a bit of a tumultuous time. And then I think that might've been like that was on a Thursday. And I think we were talking to him again after we'd met him in person, but that was an experience. We were talking to him. I think it was like on a Sunday in the morning, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. And maybe I'll meet with you guys. Maybe if you disguise, maybe, how about maybe next Wednesday? And I could hear it was really precarious. I mean, it was, the whole thing was so tenuous. And I said to Marco, let's go right now. And it was like I said, I'm going to throw it out there. Maybe it was a Sunday. We just met with him in person off the record a couple of days earlier. And I just figured it wasn't even secure. We jumped in the vehicles with our camera gear and off we went. We're driving and we're negotiating. It was a 4 or 5 hour drive. We're still negotiating. We didn't have a meeting spot. He was so paranoid about being seen with Americans, so paranoid about being seen with any camera gear, any production team, like a level of paranoia. I've never seen anything like it. So we ultimately find a hotel room. We go into the hotel room. We had no time at all. And the guy, it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the guy's like, well, hello, how can I help you? And we're like, we need a room now. Okay. Well, would you like to take a look at our suite or would you like to see this room? We'll take the suite. Like, okay. Would you like to go over the pricing? No, we'll take it now. Boom. Here's the credit card. And then all of a sudden, like all this stuff comes out of the car and the guy's just looking at us like, what on earth are these guys doing? But we only had a, 5 or 10 minute window to get the gear in the hotel room. Because if he'd come while we're loading gear, we were trying to do our best to hide the gear with towels and blankets. He was out of there. Like he was not going to be seen with, we had to get into that hotel room and get everything set up for him to walk in and just go up to the room. And we pulled it off with seconds to spare. But it was really funny. I just keep thinking back to the guy that checked us in. I don't know what he was thinking. Something really weird was going down, Anyway.
It was so worth doing because it really, again, it plugs us into the fear, the emotions, the smell, the touching. It's a very visceral experience that you give us when we have those encounters with people who were there. I'm going to ask you a left field question now, and that is, there's a beautiful voice in your movie, and I'm so glad you chose this voice because it carries such calm, and there's a compassion in the voice as well. It's the voice of Peter Coyote. And because of the ridicule factor around ET contact, ufology, I'm just personally interested to know, what's Peter's interest in this material? How did you persuade him to step forward and be part of something that's quite cutting edge in this way?
Peter accidentally, probably around 2001, 2002, something like this, agreed to narrate Out of the Blue. It was the first version of Out of the Blue. I want to say 2001, 2002, about 20 years ago, maybe a little more. And when we arrived at the studio, and again, I won't bore your audience with how it came about, but it did. And when we arrived in the studio, and I was amazed that he had agreed to narrate a UFO doc in the first time, because for obvious reasons, he's got his credibility. He works, you know. He goes, oh, I thought you were somebody else. I thought you were this other guy. And he kind of looks at me and I'm like, oh my God, no, this is falling apart. I can't believe this. And I said, and I looked at him and he looked back at me. He goes, well, I'm here. Let's just do this. And so he narrated Out of the Blue and he loved it. And then I did a director's cut, which I spent a couple more years on. And I was like, hey, do you mind like giving us an updated? And I did an updated version of Out of the Blue, which he also really enjoyed. And then for I Know What I Saw, which is my next film, which took me roughly 4 or 5 years, for some reason, I don't know why, but I narrated it myself, which I think was a mistake. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. And then for The Phenomenon, I did another film called Pretty Slick. It was on the BP oil spill, and that was also narrated by Peter Coyote. He loved that film. And then I did The Phenomenon, and of course I went back, and he said I'd be delighted. And he really loved The Phenomenon. I mean, he was proud of his participation with that film. And so then I approached him on this one. I said, Peter, this story is a little crazy, but I stand by it. I put my reputation on the line for it. He said, okay, James, I believe in you. You've never made any outlandish claims or reckless, you know, statements. I'll do it. And during, you know, he read the script and everything, and he was like, wow, this is nuts. I can't wait to see this. In fact, I need to find out if he's seen a copy of it yet or not. But that's the Peter Coyote story.
Wonderful. I'm so glad his voice is in it. It really adds, I think, to the texture of the movie. And because it's a familiar voice, I think it pulls people in to the story.
I agree with you on that.
Now, to my knowledge, Brazil is a sovereign country. It's the second or largest country in the world. So what is the U.S. Air Force doing flying in and out of Brazil in 1996 into Virginia? How could they suddenly turn up? What kind of clearance did they have? What were they doing there? And what did they get?
So another major coup for us. We were doing production. I'm trying to think what month it was. It was at the end of, I think it was at the end of 2020. It was like August of 2021. And we arrived in, Sao Paulo on our way to Virginia. We're going to be there a month. We'd done lots of background work, months and months and months of arranging interviews. Some were like, this one's for sure. This one's a maybe. We're going to go to this person's house. It was all very precarious. And as this whole thing was happening, a radar operator, control tower operator, suddenly goes public. The timing couldn't have been better. Goes public about an unannounced, unauthorized United States Air Force airplane flies into Campinas. There's the Espesex military base, which is ultimately, according to the military witnesses that we interviewed, transported the creatures from Virginia to Campinas. Okay. So this, before our film even come out and any whispers of us talking about this, this guy comes forward. Whatever compelled him to do it, I don't know. So now we're getting wind of the Americans' involvement. Then, subsequently, every single military person that we met with, and we met with quite a few, I'll mind your audience, it's all on camera, and if you listen to the the credits at the end, there were a number of military men talking about and confirming the Americans' involvement. And then, of course, the kingpin was the control officer coming forward and saying, yeah, what would the, there was this plane that came in. It didn't have, I think it's called an OM or OM, but it's an authorization from the Brazilian government to land in Brazil. And not only that, but they deviated from their intended destination, which was Sao Paulo. They went straight to Campinas. And then from Campinas, they again got authorization for two helicopters to fly from Campinas to Varginha. And this is a U.S. operation. And so we concluded beyond a shadow of doubt that, the Americans were involved. Yeah. And funny enough, you know, I sent this, an earlier version of this film to a number of contacts that I have within the U.S. government. And they were like, yep.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one as of yet, but I'm hopeful. No one as of just yet on the American side has come forward to confirm this. However, there's rumblings behind the scenes that everything in this film is accurate. And I stake my reputation on it. I mean, I don't claim to know where these beings came from. I don't claim to know why this thing crashed. It had a gash in the back of it. It was clearly in trouble. Something caused that cigar-shaped object to crash, according to the eyewitnesses that saw this big gash in the side. Something put that gash in the side of the craft, you know? Yes. So
some people listening to this would say, this sounds like a total replay of Roswell 50 years later. You've got a craft that crashes for some reason. You've got bodies that seem very vulnerable, injured. You've got local witnesses who are then silenced with military gag orders. It seems to be a similar encounter processed in a similar way 50 years later. Has anything changed since Roswell? Has anything changed since Virginia? Are we moving forward in how we respond to these incidents and then how we respond publicly?
Eu sei que era 9 horas da noite, as meninas já estavam dormindo, entre 4 homens que eu nunca vi na minha vida, todos vestidos de preto. E aí eles falaram para mim, Dona Luísa, nós estamos aqui, só um que falava. E aí eu falei, mas sobre o quê? É que a senhora fala para as meninas que elas não viram nada. Aí eu falei, moço... E eu não posso fazer isso, porque algo minha filha viu. Eu não posso tomar, pôr elas como mentirosas e ser uma mentirosa também. Eles insistiram muito. Logo saíram, foram embora. E eu corri até no portão para ver que carro que era aquilo. E saí numa fincada só. Mas não era daqui do Brasil, não. Era gente de fora.
You know, the distinct advantage that we have with this case is that it happened in 1996. So the vast majority of eyewitnesses, both military, civilian, police, fire department, are still alive. And so I'm hoping, in fact, I'm sure of this, that this is just the beginning of this story. It's a developing story. There's additional eyewitness accounts, people coming forward. We've already had a couple in Brazil. The film's only been out for a few weeks. I'm hearing rumblings of some statements that potentially are going to be made about crash retrievals in the U.S. Sorry, statements in the U.S. are going to be made. So, again, I think I said this earlier in the show. I don't think this film would have succeeded as well as it has so far. And, again, we'll see what the future holds. Prior to 2017 New York Times article where you had the secret Pentagon UFO program. And since then, there have been talk in both the New York Times and the New Yorker and other outlets of potential crash debris and bodies. So, look, man, I know it's a very tall... what's the word I'm looking for? It's a very unbelievable case, but I ask anyone out there, I completely respect and understand your skepticism. However, just listen to the eyewitness accounts. I mean, just yes. Everybody in the town of Virginia has got a small piece of this puzzle, and it's fascinating. And I'm hoping that this is just the tip of the iceberg. We know that there's additional evidence, both photographic, you know, videotaped, photographic stills of whatever it was that were these beings that were captured. And there's an ongoing effort to secure those things. But again, yeah. I remind your audience that the eyewitnesses that we met with, both the doctors, both the people that were at the military base, Ezza, they're terrified yes. of revealing just their own testimony. Now imagine if you've got a photograph or a piece of video footage, how terrified you'd be. They're terrified just to appear on camera anonymously, right? Now imagine coming forward with a piece of videotaped evidence. That's kind of a big deal. So we'll see. Time will tell. Go ahead.
So James, where are the photographs?
Well, there was an article a couple of weeks ago by Michael Schellenberger in the New York Post. And I know that New York Post is a bit of a fringe publication. However, I was shocked at the due diligence the author did. He didn't want to take my account, didn't want to take an account of videotape. He wanted to speak directly to these witnesses, which he did. And there was a guy named Victor Peccaccini who was deeply, profoundly involved in this case in 1996. He's in all the archive interviews, news appearances. He, believe it or not, made tapes for a lot of the witnesses at Ezza military base that were never to be released. I've seen those tapes. They were done for security purposes, that if anything happened to the witnesses in Brazil at the time or in the future, those tapes would be released. And they were diffused all over the world. I myself have personally seen those tapes. So Peccaccini, what I'm trying to get at here, is definitely in a position to know and have had access to both people that we met with and people that we tried to meet with. Peccaccini just came forward a couple of weeks ago and said that he was shown 35 seconds of this footage. And he describes in great detail. I would encourage your audience to go find the New York Post article that was written by Michael Schellenberger. There were two. So it's the one by Michael Schellenberger.
Yeah.
That's the one you want to read. And he talks about the fact that this thing was alive, that it was being held sort of propped up by two military men with protective gear, gloves, and face masks. They tried to give it fruit. They tried to give it water. It looked very feeble, kind of almost non-expression, just, you know, stunned and just in captivity. And it was 35 seconds. There's also another account, and he knows exactly where that is, the gentleman. I don't know if he revealed the person that showed it to him. He certainly talked about it a little bit with me off the record. But then there is another woman who's also shown photographic evidence. And, you know, she's, I don't know if she actually reveals it in the article. She might, the source of it. I know the source of it. And of course, we're following that up as well. If anyone out there thinks that there's someone that wants this more than me, then I beg you to reconsider.
We will put the link to that New York Post article in the description for the video so that people can look at that. It's a good read. Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind, if you don't mind me asking, so this is kind of an ongoing investigation. It's a developing story. It's unraveling. If anybody has a little piece of the puzzle, or if anybody has any particular, talent with FOIA requests or anything that people feel that they would like to pick up, feel free to reach out to me. I don't want people just to send me emails about a UFO they saw or speculation. I'm sorry about trying to be rude, but I just don't have the time for it. But if anyone has a piece of the puzzle regarding this case in particular, or feels that they want to act alone, that's great. I encourage your guys' help. Also, one thing I always want to come across state is that if anyone out there wants to could take the time to rate the film, that's very helpful for us. And if people want to watch the film, they should rent it from Amazon because it's the cheapest. If you want to buy the film, get it from iTunes or Vimeo because you get 2 hours of extra material for no extra cost. And I bring this up because people are constantly getting in touch with me going, why didn't you tell us I paid for the movie on Amazon? I didn't get the 2 hours of bonus material. So I said, okay, I'll let everybody know about that. And then if you want to reach out and contact me, it's James, C as in Charlie, Fox, jamescfox@gmail.com. And I'm told internationally that Vimeo and iTunes are the most successful platforms to view the film.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Yes. Many people will know the name of Dr. Roger Lear, who was an American surgeon who was involved in investigating implants or potential alleged implants. And he had a posthumous role in the formation of Moment of Contact. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. God, it's one of my biggest regrets. So I was shooting The Phenomenon, and I was also looking into, I mean, I was going out to Africa, and I went to Australia for the landing of the 66 Westall case, the Rua Zimbabwe case in 1994. I was traveling all around. And at the time in Los Angeles, I want to say it was 2013, but it might have been 2014. I think it was 2013. Roger Lear found out that I was also looking into Virginia, and I'd had been for a couple of years. At that point, it was a couple of years into it. I think I'd been there twice. And he was all excited, and he was desperately reaching out to me. And I was in Los Angeles, and I'd rented this studio space. I had camera crews, and I had flown in a lot of the witnesses from Africa on the Rua case, and I had other people coming and going at this production studio that I rented. And it was a very busy time. I actually had Kenneth Arnold's daughter, Kim Arnold, around. I was negotiating to get her to go on camera for the first time. And me, all the while, Roger Lear was contacting me. Hey, I really want to get on camera. I've got stuff I can really help you out with, the Virginia case. I went there in 2002. Please listen to me. And I said, yes, Roger, I want to meet with you. I want to get you on camera. And I just kept missing each other. And it was my fault. And he said, well, look, he was kind of upset with me. And he said, you know, I really tried and I really made an effort. I said, God, Roger, please don't take it personally. And he said, well, look, if you're not going to meet with me, at least you got to look at my tapes. I went there in 2002 and I shot all these interviews for many weeks. So he sent me those tapes. And at the time, I didn't have time to kind of go through them. And I copied them. I digitized them. I think they were shot on like Hi8 and from 2002. I digitized them and I put them in the post and I sent them back to him and I thanked him profusely. And I said, look, you know, we got to arrange to get an interview with you. And he died. I don't know if it was a week after or 2 weeks after, whatever it was, but very shortly thereafter he died. So then fast forward to 2020, probably, I'm like, oh my God, I've got those Roger Lear tapes. I got to go through them, which I did. And he'd gotten access to the deceased military officer's wife. I'm trying to struggle for her name right now, but Cherizi, but his wife, he interviewed, he was the only person to ever talk to her, ever find her, ever. And he also, with the participation of one of the leading Brazilian UFO researchers, also a lawyer, very prominent lawyer in the town of Virginia, Ubatajara Rodriguez, who'd done a completely 180 since then. I think his book came out in 2005, and either he won't talk at all, and if he does, nothing happened. It's all fantasy. Well, he doesn't believe that behind the scenes, but that's his. And the other guy, Pecuccini, had completely vanished. But in any case, I get the tapes. There's lots of gems in those tapes. And I also get his book, Dr. Roger Lear's book. And in the book, it's basically transcript primarily of the taped interviews that he had done while researching the case with Ubatajara Rodriguez. Ubatajara was leading him around, introducing him to witnesses. They had Ubatajara's son on camera who spoke fluent English. He was bilingual, basically. And he would do instant translations in the field. It was great. And in the book, Roger Lear says that Ubatajara took him to Humanitas Hospital, or took him to an to an area where he could meet with two doctors that were at Humanitas Hospital. Now, we know that there were at least one creature at Humanitas Hospital. We know that one creature was alive because it was captured alive, and it ended up at Humanitas Hospital. So that I know, according to the witnesses. And in his book, he says that these two doctors didn't want to be filmed, didn't want any recording devices in the room, but they're just going to share that what happened. This is in Roger Lear's book. I can't verify this other than the fact that it's in his book. Everything else is accurate. Everything else is a transcription from the tapes that I've seen personally. In his book, he said that the two doctors told Roger Lear that were from Humanitas Hospital that that being was alive. They did some sort of procedure to it. And during that procedure, or after that procedure, the being communicated telepathically with the two doctors and said that the human race, it was sad because the humans, this is coming from Dr. Roger Lear in his book, according to the doctors that he met with, that the human beings, the human race, they were sad for us because we didn't understand our potential. Maybe that we were warlike, we didn't understand our potential as who we really were. Something like this. Something very profound. And there was another gentleman in the room who was also a doctor who traveled to Barzinha with Dr. Roger Lear. I found him, tracked him down. I got his family, called me. He just died. Shoot. So now I have got nobody in the room other than Ubudajara, and Ubudajara refuses to meet with me. Behind the scenes, he's given us a little bit of guidance, but public, no. In fact, he agreed to meet with me, and then when we got there, he said, you know, I can't do it. So I don't know if that segment of the story is true or not. I'm hoping those doctors will come forward, you know, because that's a big deal. But I couldn't verify it. I couldn't verify it, and I didn't put it in the movie.
How has making Moment of Contact affected you and your thinking, and how do you hope it'll move the public conversation forward?
Well, I'm kind of gone all in on this one. And I know that right now it feels a little bit lonely because it's such a crazy story. And I recognize that. I recognize my inability at the time to even look into it. The knee jerk reaction of something when you hear a story this spectacular is to completely dismiss it because the unlikely nature of the event, it just seems so far-fetched that it's hard to come to terms with. It's hard to wrap your mind around. But I just ask people to try and suppress that emotion, that knee-jerk reaction, and just maintain a neutral position and listen to the eyewitnesses. Listen to the preponderance of eyewitness testimony from all walks of life in the town of Virginia, the military people, the doctors, the civilians. It's the local media. It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And I think if true, it's the biggest story of the 20th century and the biggest story probably since Roswell. In fact, I think this might be a bigger story than Roswell.
I agree. It's a thorough recommend from us at The Fifth Kind, Moment of Contact. We really do recommend people go and see it. You're absolutely on fire at the moment, James, and there's bound to be something next on the menu from you. What is coming next, and how can we keep up with what you're doing?
Well, I'm starting next week.
Of course.
I can't believe I just said that. Oh, my God. I must be nuts. But you know what? I can't put the brakes on now. We are at a tipping point, and I feel like every one of us that's pushing for government transparency, that's exposing things of cases like this, we were not in a position. We don't have the luxury to slow down at this point. We need to speed up. Because I feel like A, they can't put the genie back in the bottle. This story seems to be coming out. And now is not the time to kind of let the pressure off. I want to keep the pressure on. And also, I have a ton of unanswered questions in my own mind. You know, I got told at the highest levels of our U.S. government from the former Senate Majority Leader that what's been released, and he told me this on camera, which was absolutely one of the most amazing moments of my career in the phenomenon, that what the world is seeing that was on the front page of the New York Times is the tip of the iceberg. So where is this evidence and who has the authority to release it? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. This is no time to pause. Yeah. Where can we go to keep up with your work?
It's so funny. Everyone's kind of making fun of me now because I finally taken to Twitter. You know, I wasn't a big social media guy. I just felt like my time was much better off spent making documentaries, right? But everyone's like, you got to get the time, you old fart. You have to, it's a great tool, you know, Instagram and this. And it was like, okay, which one should I pick? So I said, fine, I'll do Twitter. So I started doing, I do a little bit of Facebook and I do a little Instagram, but, and some people have been doing some TikTok videos, but me personally, I have an official account under James Fox under Twitter, and I do updates at least biweekly, and the numbers are growing. Hopefully, Elon Musk doesn't lose his mind between now and my next tweet. But that's primarily, I think, a good platform for me right now. I'm communicating with a lot of people, and it seems to be getting traction, and more people are joining. So I would say Twitter.
All right, we will head there. James, we love what you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Fifth Kind.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you having me on.
Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv.
There was unusual activity at the base. There were helicopters from the Navy, which in itself was unusual. He sees a box. Was the box unusual?
O que me chamou a atenção foi da a Marinha tá retirando isso de dentro da enfermaria. O pessoal da Marinha queria apressar que aquela fila do banco, o pessoal saísse dali. O comandante da escola explicou que estava tendo uns boatos sobre que foram em Varginha buscar, pegar uma criatura. Que essa criatura estava lá, que a imprensa toda estava querendo entrar dentro do quartel. Eu, na minha companhia, por ser a companhia mais ligada diretamente a esse assunto, porque foi um caso que transportou, então, dentro da minha companhia, eu evitava falar. Logo em seguida, esses motoristas que tinham ido para Varginhas foram chamados lá em cima no comando do batalhão, no pavilhão, e a gente nunca mais viu.
So to this day, has he spoken to any of them that went to Virginia?
No.
No.
Nothing.
Yeah.
According to the witness, it wasn't only the drivers who were never seen again. Their captain, Edson Ramirez, also left without a word.
Ele foi para Brasília. É uma pessoa que era muito amiga de todo mundo, conversava com todo mundo, podia ajudar todo mundo. Ele não era uma pessoa que simplesmente ia falar assim, amanhã eu vou embora, não vou se pedir de ninguém.